Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, the war on gluten. Even people who don't suffer from celiac proclaim the benefits of being wheat-free. Now researchers are trying to figure out why. And Good Kids, a New Hampshire author's new coming-of-age novel, lands on Oprah's must-read list. We'll talk with author Ben Nugent about aging hippies, teaching writing, and the forgotten 90s. But first up is an alternative perspective on the State of the Union. Political parties generally blame each other for paralysis in the U.S. Congress. Writer and columnist Michael Lynn thinks it's a mistake to envision polarization as a chasm between left and right. The appropriate directions are north and south. He makes that case in a recent column in Salon, and we spoke to him about his idea the day after President Obama delivered the State of the Union. Lynn was raised in the South at a time when even children carried remnants of wounded Confederate pride.
When we were kids, we would act out war movies, either from World War II or the Civil War. And I remember there was never any trouble getting kids to volunteer to be Germans, but you could never find many to play the Yankees.
Well, of course, that's still very deep in the Southern psyche today, but where does it really fit? I mean, did you think of yourself as a minority tribe against the mainstream in the U.S.?
Well, no, and that's why I argue that what I call the third defeat of the South, the demographic defeat, is the greatest psychological shock to white Southerners, particularly conservative white Southerners. Already in Texas, non-Hispanic whites are a minority, largely as a result of Latino immigration in the last couple of generations. One Southern state after another in the next few decades is likely to become a majority-minority state. And that is a greater psychological disruption, I think, for a lot of white Southerners, even than losing the Civil War, because between the Reconstruction and the Civil Rights Revolution, the White South managed to carve out its own little apartheid country within a country, often described as a white man's country. So the dislodging of what was an overwhelmingly hegemonic ethnic majority into minority ethnic status, simply being a minority group among others, I think is driving a lot of what I describe as the hysteria and aggression of conservative white Southerners, and it influences national politics through the fact that the former Confederacy is now the geographic base of one of the two parties, the Republican Party.
Well, you come up with a series of narratives that kind of maintain this hegemony that you spoke of, narratives very distinct from the rest of the U.S., especially that of America as a melting pot. Let's dig into that a little bit. How do white Southerners think of themselves apart from?
Well, by the 1840s, most of the northern and midwestern states had multiple white ethnic groups. In addition to the Mayflower people who had come over from Britain in the colonial era, there were growing numbers of Germans and Irish, and later of Italians and Greeks and Jews and people from Eastern Europe. By the 20th century, outside of the South, there was this idea that the society was pluralistic and people had ancestors from different countries. On the contrary, in most of the South, with some exceptions, Texas had some German immigration. There were some other exceptions. For the most part, white Southerners until very recently have been descendants of people from the British Isles who came over during the colonial period, predominantly English and Scots-Irish. And so there's just not the experience of working with other white ethnic groups, Irish and German Americans, much less African Americans and Mexican Americans as equals. I think the experience of cultural pluralism among whites in the Northeast and Midwest and West Coast has made the transition to a majority-minority status for non-Hispanic whites in those areas probably less of a shock than it is for white Southerners of British descent.
So in addition to considering themselves like the true unhyphenated Americans, I think is the point you make, they also consider themselves the true believers maintaining the Protestant religion.
Well, that's right. There's no tradition of religious pluralism in the South either. Apart from Cajuns in Louisiana, there were no substantial groups of Southern Catholics. Obviously, there were some Southern Catholics. Most Jews were located in the Northeast. So for most of its history, the South was not only overwhelmingly British in descent, but overwhelmingly Protestant. And the basis of evangelical Protestantism is the claim that it is the true religion, that the evangelical Protestant version of Christianity is the true religion. So again, there's not that history of melting pot pluralism that simply is second nature in the industrial states or in even in New England, where Catholics, Jews, and Protestants have interacted politically for generations.
And of course, there has been a lot of migration to the South from the North, snowbirds, for example, but a lot of people have made their way to creating this new South. Is that taking hold in any kind of way?
Yes, and that will be the future of the South. Essentially, it's starting with the big cities and the metro area suburbs. So you have this expanding part of the South, which is more the way the rest of the U.S. has been for a long time. And I think the old South, the old white Protestant British South, increasingly is being confined to rural areas and small towns. And there's just a danger politically and even when it comes to militias, you know, in terms of law enforcement, when you have former majority groups are dispossessed, some of them adapt to the new order, others reject it, you know, and become a counterculture. So now they become adversarial and define themselves against this new culture that has displaced them.
You know, we just heard about the State of the Union from the president. How does this manifest, this idea of being the true Americans, who, ironically enough, are not part of the rest of America, how is that going to manifest politically in the future?
Well, I think increasingly this strain of American conservatism, Southern conservatism, will become more and more of a counterculture. It will be an adversary culture of an embattled minority. I think it will be dislodged within the Republican Party itself at some point. By the 2020s, the Republican Party, to remain a competitive national party, is going to have to distance itself from this kind of Southern rejectionism. So I don't see much of a future for it in national politics, but since this will be a substantial minority group, it has the potential to influence society and politics for generations to come.
Michael Lind writes for Salon.com, and you can find a link to a really stirring, thought-provoking article called The White South's Last Defeat. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Michael, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And now to another issue dividing America, whether or not to eat gluten.
Well, I don't know. I can remember, call me an old guy, when gluten was okay and we ate it freely. But now it's considered very dangerous. I believe you could hold up a bank with gluten. You know, say, do what he says. He's got gluten, you know.
The writer Dave Barry there, taking on the trend of gluten-free eating during our conversation for Writers on a New England Stage. All joking aside, celiac is a serious autoimmune disorder caused by a reaction to a gluten protein that affects about 1 in 100 Americans. A much larger proportion of the population is embracing a gluten-free diet and claiming better skin, more energy, and fewer allergies as benefits. Dr. Stefano Guandolini is medical director of the University of Chicago's Celiac Disease Center. He and his team have been studying occurrences of non-celiac gluten sensitivity, and we spoke with him about some of the facts and fallacies of the gluten backlash.
Well, gluten is a storage protein that is found in some grains, and specifically wheat, rye, and barley. Gluten appeared in a human diet about 10,000 years ago with the agricultural revolution. Until then, for the previous 240,000 years or so, there was no gluten in the diet because man was a hunter and gatherer. So this protein is really unique in that it is very hard to digest for the healthy human intestine, that is, and not everybody adapted to this new strange protein in the diet, and so some intolerances originated around that time.
I guess this is part of the argument that we as Homo sapiens are not meant to be eating gluten, especially for those who have celiac disease. Could you describe the disease and how it relates to gluten?
Sure, I will in a moment. Let me just also take the opportunity, because you asked, you said about the fact that man was not supposed.
This is the claim by a lot of people, you know, the paleo dieters.
Sure. Yeah, well, then you should be consequential with that and also eliminate all forms of milk, because, of course, man was not supposed to eat milk from cows or from goats or any other mammal. Then we should not eat eggs, because, of course, they also are part of domesticated culture. You know, it goes a long way. Once you start going that route, there is no ending there. Anyway, so going back to celiac disease, it's actually a pretty common condition. It's the most common inherited food intolerance worldwide, with a prevalence estimated currently to be around 1%. And this number seems to be repeating itself no matter where you look for celiac disease, meaning in North America, in Europe, in the Arab world, and so forth. Individuals who have celiac disease, when they eat gluten, they develop a strong immune reaction, which is an inflammation of the small intestine. And that, as a consequence, leads to destruction of some areas of the intestine called villi. Now, villi are finger-like projections that help increasing the absorptive surface of the intestine. So your digestion and absorption for many nutrients goes down. The so-called typical or classical presentation of celiac disease is gastrointestinal, with the chronic diarrhea, with abdominal pain, bloating, in children, failure to thrive, in adults, weight loss with malnutrition. Now, truth be told, we are seeing less and less of this typical presentation. And in the last decades, we are seeing more and more of more subtle symptoms, or symptoms that do not even belong to the gastrointestinal tract at all. For instance, anemia, osteoporosis, the skin condition called dermatitis herpetiformis, or DH. You may then have also conditions such as short stature. Joint pain and even joint swelling can be found in 6% of those who have celiac disease. What is of interest is that we have also found that a good portion of celiac patients, probably the majority, actually may have minimal or even no symptoms at all. So it's hard to make the diagnosis.
Well, how is celiac diagnosed?
Well, nowadays we are lucky because we have a very reliable, very accurate screening test, which is very sensitive. It's a blood test that tests some antibodies. They seem to be elevated in about 98% of celiac patients. So in other words, only 2 celiacs out of 100 do not have elevated levels of this test. Hence, it is very good for screening purposes. If you suspect celiac disease, you need to go ahead and confirm the diagnosis with an intestinal biopsy.
We're speaking with Dr. Stefano Guandolini. He's founder and medical director of the Celiac Disease Center at the University of Chicago. What is happening, however, in our contemporary U.S. and around the world, a number of people who do not have celiac claim to benefit from a gluten-free diet. So are there other types of gluten sensitivities other than celiac?
That's an excellent question, and the answer is yes. We have come to learn in the last years, really, that there are 2 other entities that can be attributed as, you know, to gluten as responsible for them. One had been known for a long time. It's wheat allergy. Outside of this, then, there is another condition, which is now being defined as non-celiac gluten sensitivity. We don't know how prevalent it is, but we think roughly it may be the same prevalence or maybe slightly more than celiac disease, so about 1-2%. And the symptoms are essentially identical to those with celiac, so they include gastrointestinal as well as non-gastrointestinal symptoms. Oftentimes, people quote things like foggy mind, fatigue is very common, and then again, GI symptoms, bloating, abdominal pain, etc. This entity, unfortunately, suffers right now from a major, major drawback for us, and that is we have no biomarkers for it. In other terms, we cannot make a positive diagnosis with any laboratory means.
Huh.
So if you do a biopsy in this patient, you find it a completely normal intestine. If you do tests for antibodies, you find them to be normal. Many websites are actually proposing sophisticated tests, even algorithms, to diagnose gluten sensitivity. In reality, this is false information. There is no biomarker for non-celiac gluten sensitivity. Hence, we have to rely only on patient's history, which makes it, you know, sometimes difficult to be sure.
people are talking about the benefits. Oh, I have better skin without gluten. I have more energy. My irritable bowel syndrome is cleared up. What's the theory on that? Why is going without gluten working for so many people?
Well, first of all, people feel better if they really want to feel better. I don't want to minimize, but at least in part, I believe that people are presenting the placebo or nocebo effect, thereby they feel better off gluten and they feel worse when they eat gluten. If you do this in a blinded fashion, some studies have shown that actually up to 50% of those who report some specific intolerances, not just gluten, but say lactose or what have you, mm-hmm. when tested properly in blinded fashion, they are able to actually document that there is indeed no such intolerance. But I am actually open and believing that in many people, removing wheat, rye, and barley from their diet actually is beneficial. Why is that? Well, in some cases, it's because if you have irritable bowel syndrome, you may actually suffer from more sensitivity to foods that belong to a category called FODMAP. It's an acronym, F-O-D-M-A-P, FODMAP. Mm-hmm. It boils down to the fact that some carbohydrate content of food, such as grains, are actually causing some symptoms because they are not well digested, and they can cause bloating, they can cause gassiness and pain. And so I would suspect, in part, those who eliminate gluten and feel better is because they are sensitive to FODMAP.
Are there any possible negative effects of following a gluten-free diet, particularly for those unafflicted by celiac?
Well, first of all, let me just go back one quick second. Gluten-free diet is the only available treatment for celiac disease. And patients with celiac disease really need to be on this diet. It's a medical necessity for them. That said, for those who don't need the diet, I actually would claim that there may be risks because, indeed, when you rely heavily on gluten-free products that are manufactured as gluten-free, you end up having foods that are somewhat richer in calories, uh-huh. in fat. They have less fibers. So you may actually run into some deficiencies, and your diet becomes a little bit unbalanced if you rely heavily on manufactured gluten-free products. Of course, if you go out, you know, and buy your own produce from reliable producers and you eat, you know, healthy diet without gluten, then there is no risk. Nobody really needs gluten. From a nutritional standpoint, gluten is a rather poor protein, doesn't really offer much.
That's a question. Is gluten sensitivity as widespread as this rise of gluten-free products that some are claiming? I mean, how can that even be tested, Dr. Guandolini?
I don't think that the current explosion boom of the gluten-free market really reflects real needs. Probably the majority of those who follow a gluten-free diet do so because they think it may be beneficial, it may be healthier, and in addition, they don't follow a strict diet. They occasionally eat normal gluten-containing food. People have done that and claim they feel better, but, you know, they have gluten now and then. So this is really a nonsense. It makes no sense from a scientific viewpoint. I do think that following a gluten-free diet has become like a fad right mm-hmm. now. You know, there have been times in which there was the Miami beach diet or the no-carbohydrate craziness in the early 2000s and so forth and so on. So people seem to have lost common sense and just enjoy the many good things that life put on our table with moderation and with a variety of food.
So you're not giving up your pasta, Dr. Guandolini?
No, I eat pasta often. I am Italian, after all. That's my bias, so I like pasta.
Dr. Stefano Guandolini, founder and medical director of the Celiac Disease Center at the University of Chicago. Thanks so much for joining us.
Prego di niente, arrivederci.
There's more in his work and on the upcoming International Conference on Celiac Disease that will be in Chicago this fall. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. Now stay with us for a new novel about a childhood crush, a few broken families, and a young man who vows to be nothing like his hippie parents. A fresh look at a tried and true oath.
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1994, 15-year-old classmates Josh and Khadija catch his father and her mother kissing at the supermarket. That discovery and ensuing fallout lead the teenage pair to vow that they will never, ever cheat on anyone. And that pact launches a coming-of-age story that reaches across years and angst with equal parts sadness and absurdity. Good Kids is the first novel by Benjamin Nugent. It's already landed on Oprah's must-read list and earned Benjamin comparisons to the likes of Jennifer Egan and Jonathan Franzen. Benjamin Nugent also teaches creative writing as a faculty member at the Southern New Hampshire University, and we are happy to have him back on Word of Mouth. Hi there.
Hi, Virginia.
So, infidelity is what really gets the plot rolling in this book. Talk a little bit about the relationship between these two kids, Josh and Khadija, and how it changes when they spy their parents kissing in the aisles of the organic food market.
Well, Josh and Khadija don't know each other very well on the very first page. And one of the first things that happens in the book is Josh is grocery shopping with his father, and they run into Khadija, who's grocery shopping with her mother. His father and her mother go off, and they spy on them because they're bored and they're awkward around each other because they're 15-year-olds of opposite sexes. And they catch their parents kissing in the supermarket. They're actually hiding in an African-American History Month display that has kente cloth draped over some tables. And seeing this gives them a kind of detective mystery to figure out together, and that winds up forming a bond between them.
Josh and Khadija are both children of the 90s. Now, this is not a generation that's really familiar to us in a lot of literature. You know, our sort of coming-of-age novels all seem to be set in the 60s. So what defines this generation for you?
Well, you know, it's my own generation. I'm a child of the 90s more than any other decade. And I think for Josh and Khadija, what about the decade defines them is the sense that the previous generation had the really spectacular historical rebellion, and that you have to be sneaky and innovative in finding a way to construe the 60s generation as this rotting husk of its former self that needs to be overturned so that you can have some kind of drama in your own history. Hmm. I think that's what makes it distinctive.
We do spend the first part of the book with the teenage Josh. In the second, he's in his late 20s. He is briefly part of a very successful band, but that's kind of gone away. And he's living this sort of in-between life. It calls to mind, you know, can we call this a coming-of-age novel when the character is not really a grown-up?
You know, I think he does start to become a grown-up towards the end. I think in that sense, it is a coming-of-age novel. It's a kind of Bildungsroman. But I think it's also a kind of coming-of-age novel about his father. I think Linus is a character who has a moral path in this book, a moral quest, almost as much as Josh, the protagonist, does.
Josh is in his apartment in Manhattan, you know, sort of imagining everyone being out, you know, someplace where he isn't, making the next Patti Smith group without him. I'm wondering about
he's in college, yeah.
This whole band experience, you know, is that based on something that you, were you in a band?
I was in a band.
Did you play the bass?
No, I was a keyboard player. But in fact, we did have one song that was in two commercials, and that's how we made all our money. And that is exactly
that
what happens to Josh. And in fact, I used the lyrics from our song as the lyrics for Josh's song, because I figured I co-wrote them technically, and so no one could sue me for using them.
You've received no shortage of praise, no, for the very sharp, very funny prose, and I'd love to hear some of your writing. Josh meets Julie. She's the host of an Animal Planet-like TV show, and they go on a date, and she reveals that she is a Republican. Can you pick it up from there?
Sure. I had the sense Julie might believe that if your parents were Republican, you had to say you too were Republican, or you were some kind of traitor. It was an ethnicity. Hence the wide-legged defensive samurai stance. This was her way of thinking, and it was easy for me to recognize because it was my own. My blood and soil identity was liberal Democrat. I felt that in declaring her partisanship, Julie had confessed she was a spy from a country at war with my own tiny, highly militant, perpetually threatened, essentially Israel-like, generally anti-Israel nation-state, the Republic of Watsbury / Cambridge / Burlington / Brooklyn / Eugene / Berkeley / Santa Cruz / Madison / Portland. I had been born one of its citizens. Thinking of myself differently because of a trifle like my views on a government policy was inconceivable. I was ready to slip behind Julie and drag her to one of my bases for questioning. Spy versus spy, I thought. I felt suspicion and desire flow between the Republican, not Republican, and me.
Well, this gets to that sort of tribe identity and really allegiance to identity. I think that that is part of a struggle in this story. Even though the relationship between Josh and Julie develops, seems good, you know, grows honest, healthy, yet he always feels this pull back to Khadija, with whom he made that childhood vow.
Yeah.
It strikes me that that vow in many ways makes him belong to something. He's got an allegiance.
That's right. It's a much clearer cultural inheritance that to have a vow you made yourself in childhood. He kind of gave himself a sort of value system that he tries to live by, but it's also kind of flimsy. You know, it was something he came up with when he was a 15-year-old.
It can also make you think you're a good person, you know, in some way. Do you know? Like, I'm staying true to this vow.
That's right. You know, staying true to the vow is ultimately something he finds very difficult to do. But I think being able to construe of yourself as a good person was what the characters of this book are always working really hard to do. And in some ways, even though the protagonist is Josh, I think the person who manages to actually make the most moral decisions toward the end is Josh's father, who he regards as the amoral foil he never wants to imitate.
Have your students read your book, do you know?
Oh, I would never expect them. I would never quiz them on it.
Well, I wonder what you tell them about writing their own novel. Like, what's the coming-of-age story for the aughts?
You know, that's an excellent question. It has yet to be written, which is one of the things that's exciting about being their age. The thing I would never do would be to show them this and be like, this is how it's done, boys and girls. And so I don't know what they would think of it. But I often encourage them to try to find a new form. You know, I mean, a lot of people have kind of tried to find a form for the aughts novel where it's text messages and Facebook or something. And it all feels a little superficial. Mm. And I feel like it has to come from people their age.
Benjamin Nugent, author of the novel Good Kids, thank you so much for
coming in. Thank you so much, Virginia.
You can find a link to more on the book, including reviews, as well as a link to Benjamin's earlier book, American Nerd. That's all on our Facebook page at Word of Mouth Radio. What you dream of now, cut it up and slip it back in. And I know, and I know, and I know. Hey, now, the smallest thing. Ben mentioned when we spoke that he'd been a member of a band with a single hit song. That's what we're hearing right now in the background. The band is The Cloud Room. And this song, Hey Now Now, was the first song ever by an unsigned band to be used in an international ad campaign. For Pepsi, no less. One of New England's biggest ice skating events takes place each February on Lake Maury, which boasts the longest groomed skating trail in the United States. Racers can bring their own hockey or figure skates or try out a pair of Nordic skates and get a feel for Swedish-style ice trekking. Sean Hurley recently took his own trek to the lake for this radio field trip.
I'm standing with my two Nordic skating companions, Jamie Hess and Paula Tracy, beside the frozen, obsidian Connecticut River.
What did you just say, Jamie?
I said you can hear the ice talking. Oh. And Paula said that's a good sign. And I said a lot of people don't understand that. But you're absolutely right.
So why?
When the ice is making noise, it means it's growing. So that's a reassuring sound.
When I was a kid and we heard the ice talking, we thought it was saying, beware of the terrible, dangerous ice. But Jamie's clear about the counterintuitive nature of ice. It gets bigger by getting smaller. It gets stronger by shattering apart. The safest ice is the clear black ice. With clear ice, you get an upstairs view of what rushes below.
You can get an idea of the immense power of that water that's all moving in the same direction and ready to grab you and pull you underneath. So,
to that end, both Jamie and Paula have come prepared. Paula wears an orange ice awl around her neck. Jamie, who also owns a ski and skate shop, has a more official-looking version around his.
In Sweden, they're called isdub, and I didn't think that was good name to sell them under in the U.S., so I decided to call them Ice Claws.
In the event of any emergency, I might have imagined, I brought my soft hat and puffy mittens. Even on the drive here, my vision of river skating took an entirely different form.
It's coming on Christmas. They're cutting down the trees. They're putting up reindeer, singing songs of joy and peace. I wish I had a river I could skate.
Before we get close to the ice, Jamie goes over some safety tips. All variations on what to do if you plunge into the void. Some of Jamie's warnings sound like forecasts. Not what to do if, but what to do when.
You're never totally submerged. You sometimes go in up to your neck, but usually not that far.
I thought this was going to be completely safe and pain-free.
You bought the wrong ticket.
No, it is completely safe and pain-free as long as you're properly prepared.
Okay,
so let's deploy some of this equipment.
I deploy a set of East Dub ice claws as Jamie hands out knee pads. The Nordic skates themselves are comically long. They look more like windshield wipers for the space shuttle than ice skates. And unlike the skates most of us are used to, they clip into a pair of special Nordic boots. Finally, Jamie hands out poles, basketless spears that also double as ice testers. While the river talking is a good sign of growing ice, it's not proof you won't fall in.
The sound only tells you that it's getting thicker and stronger, but it doesn't tell you what point you're at now. So in order to find out what point you're at now, you use these ice testing poles. Behind your back.
It's a solid 8 inches of glass, and we glide out over the edge. As one of the first U.S. importers of Nordic skates, Jamie explains his business started almost by accident.
So I went over to Sweden to learn about their skating culture and how they made it fun to be out on the ice in large groups of people. And I accidentally learned all about the special skates they used. And on the plane flying home, I decided that I wanted to start importing all this equipment and importing the sociability of ice skating as well. Basically recreating a little bit of Sweden here in New Hampshire and Vermont.
I'm soon trusting the skates. And despite all the dire talk of breakage, the ice seems good. Besides, I've never met anyone in my life who's fallen through. Paula waits until we're out in the middle of the most cracked and fragile section of the river to tell us her story.
It was on the Turkey Pond in Concord, and I was going underneath the 89 bridge. And my mother was with me, and she went under one area, and I heard her go, ah! And I came around, and I could see her holding her arms against the ice up to her shoulders in water. And as soon as I saw her, I started to sink myself. I started to feel this blackness break away and found myself in the same position. So I said, just rest, and I will break my way to the shore. And so I kept swimming in the direction of the shore, and I finally was able to... actually, I couldn't get out. I was able to look down the lake and see them sprinting towards us. And they lay person to hockey stick to person and reached out with a hockey stick to my mother and was able to pull her with a hockey stick out of the water. The same thing for me.
And yet, here Paula is, undaunted. Here we all are, with East Dubs and ice awls around our necks, with knee pads, helmets, and spear-like poles. We're heading toward cold, warm-hearted Sweden. We're headed toward whatever it was that Joni Mitchell imagined lurked along the temporary road of her frozen, wished-for river. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
It's coming on Christmas, they're cutting down trees. They're putting up reindeer and singing songs of joy and peace. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on.
And you can see photographs of Sean getting his Nordic skate legs at wordofmouthradio.org.
I'm gonna make a lot of money, then I'm gonna quit this crazy scene. I wish I had a river I could skate away on.
And coming up, A Kiss Before You Go. A widower and illustrator does what he knows. When faced with loss, he creates. We'll hear more about his memoir in watercolor when Word of Mouth continues. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Danny Gregory is an author and illustrator whose work you may have seen in the New York Times or other publications. He's also author of several books, including An Illustrated Life and The Creative License. His newest is called A Kiss Before You Go, a memoir of love and loss. It's a collection of illustrations and text compiled from daily drawings Danny did in the year following the death of his wife, Patty. Danny, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
So tell us a little bit about Patty, this woman you loved for almost 24 years.
Well, she was an incredibly sort of vivacious and chipper person. She had sort of an ability to make things seem brighter and more fun than they might actually have been. She was also a person who was a sort of a human magnet and drew all kinds of people to her. So every day she would come home and tell me that she had a new best friend that she'd met in the street. She was really a fantastic person in so many ways.
So many people were drawn to her. And even after this accident, which left her a paraplegic in a wheelchair, she really lived her life to the fullest. Then 15 years after that accident, the police call you at work and tell you that there's been another accident. What happened?
Well, Patty was... Our apartment is on the 8th floor of a building, and she was trying to reach a hose to water some plants. She leaned out the window to try and grab this hose, and because of her paralysis, she didn't have the sort of muscles in her legs to hold her, and she slipped and fell out the window. And she was apparently killed more or less instantly when she hit the ground.
It's such a terribly, terribly sad story. And I know, you know, I think we all know that grief has a few rules, but I think it understands the grief of others. And people who've experienced loss all there have their own stories of shock and wondering how we'd get through. How do you, Danny, recall those early days?
Now, I think that I was sort of wrapped in some kind of a cocoon, I think. I think I didn't fully understand what had happened in some way. I felt also kind of compelled to get on with things. We have a son, Jack, who at the time was 15, and I just felt like it was really important to sort of establish that we were still okay in some way. I think it took a while for grief to come and hit me in the giant waves that it can. Mm. So it was a constantly changing process.
And you kept up on what had become a daily practice for you, illustrating your life, doing, I guess, an illustration a day at least. Was that an immediate response for you, and what did it provide?
I think it began, I think there was probably a week or two where I didn't draw. But I think my journals always focus on just sort of my daily life, what I had for breakfast, or drawing my dogs when we go for a walk, sort of small little things. And somehow drawing these things in these days after kind of kept me in touch with them, with the fact that there was still beauty in the things around me and that life was going on. I also started to draw a lot of the things that Patty had left behind, you know, her jewelry, papers piled on her desk, that kind of thing. It was a way of sort of stopping and meditating on them, capturing how I was feeling. I just had this general sense that this is obviously a very important event that I was going through, but I felt like I wanted to hold it and to own it. I didn't, you know, it was painful, but I also felt like it was really important and it needed to be captured somehow. I wasn't sure quite why.
Well, after living so long with this woman who was so magnetic and vivacious, was it difficult for you to live up to the kind of grace with which she met her own challenges? I mean, did you ever end up comparing yourself to that?
All the time. I mean, she provided so much in our lives that I never felt adequate to. You know, I worried that I would end up completely alone, that I would lose all the network that she had built up and all the people that she had brought into our lives. And also the sort of look on the brighter side aspect of things that she had brought to me. I thought, how am I going to sort of carry this on by myself?
It strikes me that the book captures a year, and I'm thinking of fairly recent books by some literary widows. The Year of Magical Thinking, Joan Didion wrote, A Widow Story by Joyce Carol Oates, both of them about the loss of long-term partners. What do you think it is, Danny, about a year? What does that chunk of time give us?
I think it's a traditional period of grieving. They told me from the beginning, they said it takes about a year to get through this. Certainly in certain religious traditions, like in Judaism, that's when you grieve traditionally, and you then after a year you're supposed to stop. So there's something about going through all the cycles of the seasons that seem, to go through Christmas, to go through birthdays, to live through the whole cycle seems part of the process somehow. Mm.
We're talking with the author and illustrator Danny Gregory. He's written a new book. It's called A Kiss Before You Go. It's a memoir of the year following the death of his wife, Patty. A very beloved, very close, very interesting couple to me. But several of the illustrations in A Kiss Before You Go are of you. And one of the most poignant for me, anyway, is when you are saying goodbye to Patty. It's almost a perspective as if lying on a gurney where she must have been at the time. You are so sad and so sort of hardened in a way, or maybe trying to face the world, with a stiff jaw. I don't know. But there are a number of different portraits of you. So how were you changing throughout this process?
You know, that particular drawing is in black and white.
Mm-hmm. It's one of a few.
It's funny, when in my journal, more or less the year leading up to her death, I was drawing more or less always in black and white and in shades of gray. And somehow when she died, I transitioned to color and I was doing everything in bright colors. But that particular drawing and the other drawings that I did of myself, I often felt like I drew myself like a sort of deer in the headlights sometimes. And other times I was a little tiny figure surrounded by the huge clutter of our apartment and all the life that we had. You know, I felt like I was looking into myself all the time, and I was trying to understand me as much as anything through this process. I felt like a different person and a stranger to myself a lot of the time.
That's the thing. I think you become a stranger to yourself. Life is not as imagined. I lost a younger brother now 11 years ago, and the idea that there's an amputation or you have this kind of phantom limb that you can still feel. It's almost as if, like, you cannot imagine life without somebody, but then you learn that you can have one. And there's something so strange about that.
It's true. I mean, I felt like our lives were so intertwined that I couldn't imagine how it would be possible for me to carry on. I mean, our life was our life, and suddenly one part of it wasn't able to go on. I think that's what this book is about, really, is about that process of these daily events, these little things, shopping for groceries, cleaning my house, going through closets, all those small things, and realizing one by one that I can do each of these things. Mm-hmm. A lot of them were things that hadn't even been my responsibility necessarily, because Patty worked out of the house and I was at my office. So it was somehow being able to do each one of them, one after the other over the course of the year, that made it seem to me like, okay, I am still alive. I am still doing things. And she is part of every single one of them. You know, even though she's not here, her influence, her taste, her voice were all there in the little things I did. I carried on making lunch for my son every single morning before he went to school. And doing that, going to the supermarket and picking out, like, what would be the things that she would put into the lunchbox to surprise him? How do I keep that going? I just wanted him to feel like her presence there throughout, and it just felt comforting to me as well.
And you and your son, there's a lovely little video, we have a link to it at wordofmouthradio.org, that you made together of you having breakfast and drawing. So what has happened in your relationship? He obviously has gone through his own experience of grief. He lost his mother.
He was also, as I said, he was 15 then, he's 18 now, and teenage boys are not known for being very open with their emotions and talking about how they feel in any case. But Jack was always has always been like a stoic kid. You know, he grew up with a mom in a wheelchair. He was 10 months old when she was injured. So he's always been slightly different from everybody else, but always very resilient and tough. But I was afraid that he would be too tough, that he would not be able to open up, and that he would sort of keep all these feelings inside of himself, and then they might take 10 or 15 years to come out, and then what would happen to him? So I was very worried about that. For me, part of keeping this journal and doing this book was to show him what I was thinking, to share it, to say, it's okay to feel this way. It's okay to not know how you feel. It's okay to feel like other people don't understand what you're going through. I think we became best friends in a way we never had been before through the course of these years together. Because we were suddenly equals in a way. I was no longer just his dad. I was his roommate and his best friend and his caterer and his launderer and so forth.
And that book, I think, provides similar things for us, connects to our grief. It's a way that we know we're not going through things alone.
Everybody faces death at some point. You know, the death of a loved one, of a parent, of a sibling, of a friend. And it was an experience that I was completely unprepared for. You know, I really hadn't thought about it much, or if I did think about it, I would push it away. So I didn't know what it was going to be like. I'd heard about the stages of grief. I didn't fully know what they are. I'm not even sure that I really went through them in the way that one's supposed to. But I just didn't know what it would be like. I would have fantasies sometimes while Patty was still alive, what would it be like if she was suddenly gone. But it was really very different. You know, I think in the end, even though this was a horrible experience in a lot of ways, I found like I wanted to get some beauty out of it. I wanted it to be a positive and a learning experience and something that I could share. And I hope that that's what this book is in the end. It's not a grim, scary book. I hope that it's something that will help people and will show them, prepare them for what they might go through one day.
Danny Gregory, author, illustrator, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
His newest work is A Kiss Before You Go, a memoir of love and loss. And you can learn more about it on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us today for a few stories that aroused our curiosity. If you liked what you heard, drop us a line. Or if you're the sharing kind, you can post links to our content on your Facebook page or on Twitter, or email them along to friends. All it takes is the click of an icon over at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again for more Word of Mouth next week from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby, Zach Nugent, Jonathan Lynch,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with plenty of help from our interns,
Ali Kuzmikas
and Logan Shannon.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board.
Actually, that sounds pretty good.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals,
and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to our past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr at Word of Mouth Radio.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth
is a production of New Hampshire
Public
Radio.
Oh, it's Word of Mouth, eh?
That's fancy, right?